Jesus looked around the table at his 11 men that were left with him. And he saw that they were very discouraged, deeply depressed over the announcement that he has just made to them that he is about to leave them and they cannot come with him. Finally, to try and give them some courage, he says to them, "Let not your heart be troubled. In my Father's house are many rooms, and I go there to prepare a place for you. And believe me that if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, so that we can spend eternity together." That really didn't help a whole lot. Finally, Philip said, "Lord, we'll be very happy the fact that you're going away and leaving us if you would just show us the Father before you go." And as he said so, it was just like driving a knife into Jesus' heart. You can almost see the tears well up in his eyes as he turns and he looks at him and he says, "Have I been with you so long that you haven't yet seen him? When I stooped down and put my arms around that woman who had been brought in adultery to be stoned, and I told her to go and to make a change in her life, didn't you see the Father? When I stood before Lazarus' tomb and called, 'Lazarus, come forth,' and he did so, didn't you see the Father? When the children would come and sit on my lap, they would fall asleep in my arms as I would tell them stories. Didn't you see the Father? The Father and I are one. And if you've seen me, you've seen him." And so it is that Jesus goes on with one of the most beautiful discourses found for us in the Gospel of John, chapter 14. We're told now as he comes to a close, they took a small offering among themselves for the poor. They sung a hymn together. And they now quietly slip out of the upper room. As they open the door and go down the stone stairway that was on the outside of the building to the street below, they have no trouble finding their way along the darkened streets of Jerusalem, for the Passover moon is full. As they move from shadow to shadow, there is little difficulty. The city has really almost fallen asleep now. Every once in a while, they were passed by a door that shows a little flicker of light underneath. And if they would pause and listen, they would hear a family inside celebrating the Passover together. But the streets are basically bare of people. Oh, there's a few of the riffraff that sleep on the streets every night that have found their favorite little corner. And as the disciples and Jesus slip on by, they look up in their drowsiness just to see a group of men going by and soon are lost again in their deep dreams. The eastern gate of the city of Jerusalem was always left open 24 hours a day during Passover week. During that week, it was never closed. And so as Jesus and his disciples now slip out the eastern gate, they bid goodnight to the gatekeeper. And now quickly, the path drops down to the Kidron Brook. Historians tell us that there was no bridge over the Kidron at this time. And so Jesus and his disciples have to pick their way carefully across the stream, for it has been flowing blood red from the blood that has been coming from the altar inside the temple that week. Unless they stain their garments, they raise them as they step over from stone to stone. As they do so, they startle a nightingale off from her singing there in the evening, and she flies off into the darkness. A frog ceases his croaking for a few moments. And now they continue their way and begin to ascend now the Mount of Olives. And we're told that on the way to the Garden of Gethsemane, there was a grape vineyard. And as they passed along that pathway, they came along a big stone wall that had been built around that vineyard. And a grapevine had escaped from a trellis and was growing up along the top of the wall. And Jesus now pauses in the moonlight and gathers his 11 men around him And he reaches out and he picks up the vine and he holds it tenderly in his hand. And he says to them, I am this vine, and you are the branches. And if the branches stay connected to the vine, you will bear much fruit. But if you are not connected, you can bear no fruit at all. And then he carefully turned and laid the grapevine back down on the wall. And they continued now their journey up the mountainside. Historians tell us that they came to a fork in the path. The fork that went off to the right continued to climb the mountain, and as it crested, it would drop quickly then into the little town of Bethany. The fork that branches off to the left goes into the Garden of Gethsemane. And there in the moonlight, as Jesus comes to the fork in the path, his disciples notice that he stops. And he pauses there in the moonlight as if he is weighing very heavily a decision as to which way they would go this evening. If they would go to Bethany, Jesus would go to a place of relative safety and peace for the night. But if they turn and go into the garden, Jesus knows what awaits them there. Long he stood, and finally with a sigh, he turned and walked into the garden. It was probably 2 or 3 hours later that another group of men begin to move through the streets of Jerusalem. It's an amazing group. If you were standing in the shadows and watched them go by, you would hardly have believed what you had seen. Never had there been such a conglomerate group of men from different classes in all one little clump moving along the streets of Jerusalem. For in this crowd, there were Roman soldiers moving with all of their iron armor and their great red capes and their great swords. There were riffraff, those that had been sleeping now along the streets as they hear the soldiers coming along and they open and they see the group. They shake off their heaviness and arise and they too follow. Perhaps the most startling man in the group of all was a very tall, dignified man with a great flowing gray beard. And the riffraff of the streets cannot believe that they are moving in the same crowd with the high priest himself. Indeed, what is Caiaphas doing out here tonight in a group like this in the dead of the night? Moving with the hated Roman soldiers. Surely this created a bit of curiosity. And the whole group seems to be led by another very tall, good-looking man. A man who carried himself with great dignity and composure. A man who stepped with deliberateness, who seemed to know what he was about this night. The whole group, soldiers and riffraff and Caiaphas, are following the tall, distinguished form of Judas. They too bid goodnight to the gatekeeper as they now slip out to the eastern gate. Caiaphas is very careful to rift his high priestly garments as he steps across the stones of the Kidron, lest he get them stained or defiled with the blood that is flowing down it. And now as they come into the garden, the tall, distinguished Judas now brings them up into the shadows. And he lifts up his hand and he gives them instructions. He tells them now to wait where they are. He will point out the one that they are to take that evening. And he turns to the Roman soldiers and he says to them, the one that I kiss, he is the one that you should take. But be very careful that you tie him up tightly. And now Jesus has heard them coming. And he has arisen and he stands and he waits for them now to move out into the opening amidst the olive trees. As Judas now steps forth, he comes over And he feigns with great acting ability sorrow for the circumstances of the evening. And coming over to him, he now takes Jesus with one hand upon each shoulder and slipping his hands behind him, he begins to kiss Jesus. He doesn't just kiss him once, but he kissed him profusely. He kissed him on this cheek and that cheek and upon the forehead and he kisses him everywhere. For Judas wants to make sure that Jesus never forgets the fact that Judas was present that night. For you see, Judas has no intentions at all this evening of betraying Jesus to his death. Judas has worked out a very well-calculated scheme and plan in his mind in which he feels that by the ingenuity of his own mind, he is going to be able to get Jesus upon the throne. And after the events of this spectacular evening are over, and Jesus sitting upon the throne sits back and reviews the events that have literally propelled him to the Messiahship of Israel, that he will realize the great part that Judas has played in this. And Judas, of course, will be awarded the greatest place in the kingdom beside Jesus. Judas always sort of hung back when the other disciples got into the arguments about who was to be the greatest. He sort of innerly sneered at their inability to be able to arrive at a position like that without fighting over it. Judas was sure that his craftiness would see to it that he would have that place. There were several times during Judas's life, and especially the years that he is with Jesus, that he aspires for great position. And there were certain times during his days that he walked with Jesus that he thought that they were on the brink of it. Judas was so excited when they fed the 5,000. We're told that Judas moved among the disciples and among the crowd that evening after the feeding. And he said, "Listen, it is obvious that Jesus is never going to make himself the king. Let us take him and put him upon the kingdom tonight. Let's do it by force." And we're told that in that chapter, in the Desire of Ages, on the feeding of the 5,000, that Jesus actually had to gather his disciples together that night and very firmly command them to get into a boat and leave him alone. For they were stirring up the people so badly. And they didn't want to do it, and we're told that it was the first time that Jesus had ever spoken firmly with the disciples. He said, "Listen, you get out in that boat and you get across there and you meet me tomorrow in Capernaum." And reluctantly, they left the crowd alone with Jesus and they get into the boat, but instead of pushing out and immediately sailing across the sea as Jesus has directed them, we're told they pushed off a short way and set out in there and looking back at the shore, grumbled and complained over the way Jesus has just now treated them. Instead of sitting out there in the boat and praising God for the fantastic miracle of the feeding of this tremendous multitude, they're sitting out there complaining. Jesus finally is able to dispense the crowd that night, and we're told that he slipped off onto a hillside, and he knelt down where he could look out over the sea and where he could watch his disciples. He never let them out of his sight. And he began to pray for them. Oh, how he prayed for them that night. And it was that night that this terrible storm comes up and is about to envelop them. And Jesus comes and walks out across the water to meet them that night. You know, it's very interesting. We're told that storm never would have come that night had they obeyed him. And had they gone directly to Capernaum as he had directed. But because they sat out there and grumbled and complained, they needed this lesson that night. There were many other times that Judas had conspired to make Jesus the king. He was greatly disappointed when Jesus sent the rich young ruler away. For once they had somebody come into their midst with a little bit of money. Somebody who could do something for them. As he looked around at Peter and Matthew and some of these other individuals that were following, he didn't have the highest regard for them, for really, what could they do to help? And when the rich young ruler had come along, Judas was very excited about that and keenly disappointed when Jesus had sent him away. I guess Judas really began to put this whole scheme all together about a week before. They had been at the feast at Simon's house. Mary had just broken the alabaster box and had used this precious ointment on Jesus' feet. And now for the very first time, Jesus speaks openly in rebuke to Judas when he said, "Leave her alone." And the pen of inspiration tells us that Judas walked out of there that night and he determined that he was going to have his revenge. Now his revenge was not to see Jesus on the cross. His revenge was to see Jesus on the throne. And to have everybody sit back and realize that it was his brain that did it all. That was the revenge that he was seeking for. For Judas is sure this night that if he can develop and create a situation so precarious for Jesus, that Jesus will be literally forced to free himself, forced to save himself from the clutches of Caiaphas. And as he does so in the presence of Caiaphas, Caiaphas then will be forced to recognize Jesus' power and Jesus' messiahship, therefore throwing the support of the Sanhedrin behind Jesus, therefore making Jesus the king, and therefore Jesus would owe it all to Judas. This is why he says to the Roman soldiers, "Tie him up tightly." For later on, when he knows Jesus is going to be free, if the Roman soldiers say anything to him about it, he can always say to them, "Listen, I told you to tie him tightly, didn't I?" He thinks he's covered all the angles. And now, of course, he's finished kissing Jesus, and Jesus says, "Oh, Judas," he says, "would you do it this way?" And I think that really emphasizes the truth of the matter. If you were going to betray a friend to his death, you wouldn't do it like that. You would have stood back in the shadows under the olive trees and you would have said to the soldiers, "It's that one over there. You know, go get in." And really, that wouldn't have even been necessary, for they all by this time knew who Jesus was. And now the soldiers come and they tie Jesus tightly as Judas is directed. And the disciples, now awakened by the clamor and the noise of it all, and they want to do something about it. And great, mighty Peter, who has just that night made a vow to Jesus that he will die with him, he means it. Peter was no coward in the face of physical combat. And please don't ask me why Peter had a sword with him. I have no idea, but for some reason he's got one. And he whips it out and he comes into the fray and he doesn't care if there's Roman soldiers there with their armor. He is going after them. He will save his Lord. He will die for him as he has told Jesus he would. And I'll tell you, he meant business as he came in there with that sword. He wasn't just, you know, swinging it around and hacking it like this or that. You don't do damage that way. You do damage by turning your sword flat and swinging it across this way. And thus it is that a young man looks up just in time to see that sword coming. And he ducks just in time as the old sword whips by. And as he ducks, it takes off his ear. And he cries out in pain as he reaches up and he puts his hand on the side of his head. And the blood drops begin to now flow freely down the back of his hand. And we're told that Jesus saw this man in pain. And even though they were his enemies, Jesus hurts when people hurt. And we're told he just reached out, stooped down, picked up the ear, drew the man over to him, and put it back on. And Judas cannot believe what he hadn't expected it so soon. I mean, you know, he thought maybe they would get on into Jerusalem before this would have to happen. Maybe they would get in before the, you know, in Caiaphas' court itself, but right here, already in the garden, it's worked. And Judas stands back in the shadows with a tremendous sense of satisfaction. Oh, how it all has worked. He's a bit puzzled as he sees the Roman soldiers grab Jesus again and retie him. I've often wondered what was going through the mind of that soldier as he ties him for the second time. You know, what if he got his hand out of there? And Judas thinks to himself, well, perhaps later on this evening, perhaps the situation isn't crucial enough. Now, Jesus, of course, has called Peter and the disciples off from their combat, and they're confused now. If Jesus doesn't want them to fight for him, what more can they do? And we're told that it was actually Peter himself who turns to the other disciples and says to them, "Let's get out of here." And they all run back into the trees as a result of Peter's suggestion. And now they grab Jesus and they drag him from the garden and down the mountain and across the stream and up into the city. And he is taken now first to the house of Annas. It's rather interesting that Jesus is taken first to the house of Annas. Annas, as you'll remember, was the ex-high priest. Ever strike you strange, the fact that there was an ex-high priest around? I mean, you remember when the high priestly system had been set up, a man was supposed to be a high priest for life? And how is it that you have an ex-high priest around if a man is a high priest for life? Well, history tells us that in those years before the coming of Jesus to this earth, that the position of high priest in Israel had become a very, very lucrative position of graft and greed. A position where a man, once he had obtained that position, would be able to, you know, to get rich in a very, very short time. And so it was that after a man had been a high priest for what his colleagues felt was long enough to get his, if he did not step down and retire, then he would be retired physically. And we have a whole history of assassinated high priests before Caiaphas and Annas. Matter of fact, historians tell us that it got so bad that one high priest actually was assassinated by being drowned in the laver right in the temple itself. It was so bad. Now Annas, he was smart enough to realize when he got his. And so we're told that he retired. And he made his son high priest. And then after his son had been in long enough to get his, he retired and Annas' second son became high priest. And after he had been high priest long enough to get his, he retired, but Annas had run out of sons. And so now he starts on his son-in-law's. And so it is that Caiaphas is now high priest, Annas' son-in-law. But interestingly enough, it was still Annas who was the godfather behind it all. Matter of fact, historians tell us that all of the corruption that was going on in the temple in Jesus' day, the cheating on the sheep and the cheating and the money changing, all of this had been established under the direction of Annas. And that he was getting a big cut of it, even though he was retired now. It was no wonder that Annas hated Jesus. In the last 3 years, Jesus has driven his cattle bargainers and his money changers out of that temple 2 times. And when you strike a man at his pocketbook, you're really striking him close to his heart. And Annas hated Jesus so. And it is very interesting that it is to Annas that Jesus is brought first this night. And as he is brought into the courtroom of Annas, Annas begins to question him. And he begins to say things to him like, "Tell us now, what secret things do you tell your men when nobody's around?" And Jesus said, "Listen," he said, "you've had spies following me for the last 3 years. They know everything that I've said. Why don't you ask them?" And we're told at this point, one of the soldiers that was standing close by reached out and slapped Jesus across the face as hard as he could. And he said to him, "How dare you speak to the high priest this way?" Rather an interesting slip of the tongue. Since Annas wasn't anymore the high priest. But it shows the authority the old man still wielded in the circles of government in Jerusalem. Jesus turned to the soldier and he said, "Listen," he said, "why did you hit me like that?" He says, if I've spoken evil against you, then hit me, but I have done no such thing." Meanwhile, we must not forget the disciples out in the garden. Somewhere in the shadows of the olive trees, Peter and John bump into each other. He says, Peter, is that you? Yeah, it's me. And John, is that you? He says, well, what do we do? I wonder where they took him. And together now they find their way out of the garden and into the city, and they're moving quietly from shadow to shadow through the streets, and they soon know where Jesus is. For as they come along the courtyard outside the house of Annas, they hear the rabble over the wall in the courtyard on the inside. And they want so badly to know what's going on inside there. And they're standing in the shadows wondering how they can get in. And as they're standing there, a man comes walking down the street. And as he walks down the street, he comes and he knocks on the door by the gate. And the gate is opened, and as it is open for this man to slip inside, John turns to Peter and he says, hey, I know the girl who is keeping the gate. I just wonder if she will let us in. And very cautiously now, they come over and they knock on the door, and the gate is open, and the girl looks out, and indeed she does recognize John. But we're told she didn't let him in right away. She closed the door again in his face. And she turned around and she said to some of those that were in authority on the inside, she says, there are some of his disciples on the outside. Should we let them in? And they conferred with each other and they said, yes, let them in. For we are going to so humiliate their Lord this night that truly by their seeing it, they will lose faith in him. And the door was open and Peter and John were allowed in that courtyard for the express purpose of seeing Jesus humiliated. Now as they come inside, the courtyard is filled with all the riffraff and everyone that has come along in the group that night. John forgets that Peter is with him. John has but one desire, and that is to get as close to Jesus as possible. We're told that the courtyard was fixed up out here with a large porch on this side, and the porch was open, and it looked into now the courtroom of Caiaphas himself, and you could see inside what was going on by standing down in the courtyard. But John wants to get as close to Jesus as he possibly can. And John now works his way through the crowd, and he comes and he finds up on the porch a corner in the shadows where he can stand as close and see and hear everything that's going on. Peter, we're told, doesn't want to be quite so identified, and he now tries to lose himself in the crowd. As he does so, he wanders over with a group and he watches the humiliation that Jesus is undergoing. He can hardly believe it as he sees someone come up and grab Jesus by the beard, a great handful, and wrench it out. Hair and flesh and everything, and a great open wound appears on Jesus' cheek. Peter cannot believe when some wretched soul comes over and clears his throat and rolls it around in his tongue and flings it out in Jesus' face. He cannot believe nor bear the sound of the word bastard that is thrown at Jesus, for they are all well aware of Mary's condition before she was wed to Joseph. They have researched, they have checked, they know. And Peter is so humiliated by all of this. And he is standing there and there are tears running down his cheeks, and someone looks over and they see the tears and they see his affected condition. You're one of his men, aren't you? And Peter's quite startled. He hadn't expected that. And he said, well, no, I'm sorry. You've got me confused with someone else. Not me. And the Bible tells us the cock crowed. Have you ever heard of something and it registered, but it didn't register? And Peter heard the cock crow. It registered mentally, and yet it didn't. It was sort of filed away in his brain for about an hour or so later. And he now disappears from this group, and he goes to another group, and he is recognized again there at that group. And finally, he just can't believe that they keep picking him out of the crowd. And so he goes off to a third position. And now to try and hide his identity, and I can hardly believe this, my heart breaks so for Peter. But it is true, the pen of inspiration tells us that Peter, in order to try and hide his identity, actually now comes to the front of the group by this fire, and he begins to join in the verbal abuse of Jesus. He actually begins to call out names and jeer and shake his fist with all of the others. I can hardly believe it, but it's true. Oh, how my heart breaks for the man. I don't think we can understand the kind of internal pressure that is going on. I mean, this is the man who he walked on the water with. This is the man who he saw glorified on the mountain of transfiguration. This is the one who knelt just a few hours before and washed his feet. And Peter stands there and he ridicules him with a crowd. But somehow as he did it, there were tears in his eyes and his voice was crackling and it just wasn't coming out right. And he was acting so poorly that the people again were attracted to him and turned. And they said, "Surely you are one of his men." And again, to try and cover his identity, all of the four-letter words that he had ever learned as a fisherman on the Sea of Galilee come spewing out of his mouth in an avalanche of filth. And he says, "I know not the man." And the cock crowed for the second time. And the words of Jesus had come true. Jesus had said, "Before you, the crow will crow twice tonight. You will deny me three times." And it all comes flooding back to him. And almost with a shock, he awakens to himself and he turns and he looks up at Jesus. And he sees that Jesus is looking directly at him. For a fleeting moment, those two men are looking eye to eye, and Peter knows that Jesus has heard every filthy word he has just said. And Peter turns and he looks back into the fire, and his whole life just flashes before him in a few moments. And we're told he looked up from the fire now through tear-blurred eyes, and he looks up to see Jesus just in time to see a great hand reach out and literally punch Jesus across the side of the head. And Peter himself reels with the punch and realizes that he has hurt Jesus far more than that punch has. And we're told that Peter could not stand himself. And he turned and he fled from that fire to the door of the courtyard and he just threw it open and he ran down through the streets of Jerusalem weeping and crying. And he didn't know where he was going. He was just running. And somehow in the blindness of his tears, he's out the eastern gate and down across the Kidron, and he isn't careful the way he goes across this time. He just goes. And he's up that path, and he turns to the left, and he's in the garden, and he falls down at the very place where Jesus is just agonized in prayer. He can see where Jesus' fingers had actually literally dug into the ground as he was holding on, as he was praying, "Oh my God, if there's any other way..." And Peter now mingles his tears in the dirt with the blood drops of Jesus. And he cries out, "Oh God, let me die. Oh God, I'm not fit to live. I'm just a filthy worm. Let me die here tonight." And for the first time in 3.5 years of walking with Jesus, we're told Peter is a converted man. For that night, Peter realized what kind of a person Peter was. And it was only Jesus Christ who was really pure and good. And I praise God that Peter did die in that garden that night. The old man Peter died there. And later that morning when the sun came up, a brand new Peter walked out of that garden. Meanwhile, we must not forget that back in the courtroom there are still two more disciples. Judas is getting a little panicky by now. Things are going much farther than he'd expected. He just, you know, you know, all the spitting and the hitting and the hair pulling, and he hadn't expected all that. And finally the horrible realization comes flooding over Judas that Jesus is not going to free himself. That this day Jesus is actually going to be crucified. And this sudden awareness floods Judas with a horror. And great drops of sweat now begin to appear on the beads of his forehead, and his face turns pale, ashen white. His hands go cold and clammy. And he has a burden that is hanging around his waist that feels like a ton. And he reaches over and he grabs the bag from his belt. And he now comes running from the shadows into the midst of the courtroom, and he throws the money on the floor, and he says to Caiaphas, "Caiaphas, you've got to let him go. This man has done nothing wrong." And we're told that Caiaphas was astonished, and he didn't know what to say. I mean, it was obvious now to the whole multitude the treachery and the perfidy of the evening. Finally, Caiaphas gathers his self-composure, and he says, "My friend, that's your problem, not mine." For we're told that Caiaphas despised Judas. You know, men will use traitors, but they despise them while they're using them. And Judas now turns and he falls right at the feet of Jesus. And he hangs on to Jesus' garments and he's hanging on. He looks up and he says, "Oh Lord," he says, "I know you can do it. Let's get out of here. I know you can. Listen, I was with you at Nazareth when they tried to throw you off the cliff and you just disappeared. I was with you once in the temple when they tried to stone you and you just walked through in their midst. Oh Lord, let's do it again." And Jesus looked down at Judas, and we're told that those that were there were amazed, literally amazed, at Judas' expression. For there is not one bit of animosity, there is not one bit of resentment or hate. But with great tears, Jesus looks down at Judas and he says, "Judas, I tried to tell you, didn't you understand that this is what I came for?" And we're told that Judas stood up and he looked at the multitude and he said, "It is too late, it is too late." And he went rushing from the courtyard, down the steps, down through the courtyard, out the very same gate that Peter has just gone out. And he too now finds himself running through the streets of Jerusalem, seeking for some escape. And he too went out the eastern gate, for it was the only gate open. And somewhere on his way out the eastern gate, we're told that he found a great rope. And he went up on the north side of the city on the way to Calvary. And he knew of a great tree that hung out over a precipice there. And as the Passover moon was setting in the wee early morning hours, Judas threw the rope over a great branch and fastened it down to the base of the tree. Forming a great noose, he put it around his own neck and pulled the rope knot tight up under his ear. And with a great cry of anguish, he jumped. And we're told that the rope that he chose was not strong enough for him because he was a big man, a tall, heavy individual. And the rope snapped. Judas's body went cascading down into the rocks below, and as it hit the rocks, it burst open. And we're told that the dogs who fed on the garbage piles outside the city now came and began to feast on the burst open body of Judas. Already, the cost of the evening is coming home. Meanwhile, there is still one more disciple in the courtyard. We must not forget him. He too goes out the east, that open gate in the courtyard that night, but he did not go out like the other two. He walked out with a heart full of confusion, a heart full of agony and sorrow, but a heart full of love for Jesus Christ, his Lord. John will go through the whole ordeal this evening. And he will never hide his identity and he will never deny who He is. It is no wonder that out of all of the apostles, it is John who is the last one to pass away. He is the one who stuck through it all in thick and thin. You know, it wasn't because they didn't try and kill John. They did. You know, they killed all of the other disciples. Every one of them, one by one, met a horrible death. Peter crucified upside down. Andrew crucified. Bartholomew skinned alive. They took John. And tradition tells us that they got a great pot of oil. And they put the wood under and they lit it and they got the oil burning, really going and boiling, and the pungent oils and smoke coming up and rising. And they took the old man and they tied him up and swung him out over the pot of boiling oil, and then they began to let the rope out. And they got him down so that the bottoms of his feet were just resting on the top of the boiling oil, and they hold him there listening for him to scream. But he doesn't scream. And so they let him in up to his ankles. And he doesn't scream. And so they let him in up to his knees. And he's just smiling. And they finally let the rope go, and he's in. And as surely as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego walked through the burning, fiery furnace, John sat in that pot of boiling oil, and there wasn't a thing they could do to hurt him. Now, when you can't kill a man or shut him up, the next best thing you do is you put him off on a little island somewhere where he can't preach to anybody. And that's why John ended up on the island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea. They didn't think he could do anything out there. He wrote the book of Revelation. He wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. And he wrote the Gospel. Couldn't do anything out there. Interestingly enough, historians tell us that John did not die on the island of Patmos. He finally got so old, so decrepit, that they thought that he couldn't do any harm anymore, and they let him go. And there's a beautiful tradition that says that John spent his last years in the city of Ephesus, where Paul had used for 3 years as a center for his missionary endeavors. And at every Sabbath morning, when all of the saints would come together to worship, that there was a very special seat in the front for John. Very sacred seat, because, I mean, he was the last of the 12. And every Sabbath morning, the old man would come and he would sit in the seat. And Pastor Titus or Pastor Timothy would have the morning sermon. And then before he closed, tradition tells us he would always turn and he would say, John, do you have a message for us this evening? And every Sabbath morning, the old man would shake his head, yes. He had something to say. And the pastor would let him up. The old man would come and he would stand in the center of the aisle and he would look back over the people that were in church. And he would say to them, my little children, love one another. And then he would sit down. The next Sabbath, the pastor would say, John, do you have anything to say to us? And the old man would shake his head, yes. And he would get up and he would turn to the crowd and he would say, my little children, love one another. My little children, love one another. It was in John that it is recorded that Jesus says, hereby shall men know that ye are my disciples, if you love one another. Not if you can quote a lot of scripture. Not if you can build great institutions like Loma Linda and Andrews. Not if you know the 2300 days backwards and forwards and eat chocolates. None of those things. My little children, people will know you are my disciples if you love one another. If you have genuine care about each other. So it is, the great cry goes out to the Seventh-day Adventist Church today, my little children, love one another. Oh, please, somehow, let's stop the rat race of materialism and everything else, and give our attentions to taking care of the needs of those that sit beside us in church on Sabbath morning. Oh, somehow, if we could be more concerned about the family problems and the real, genuine temptations that some of our folks are struggling with. When our young people come into church on Sabbath morning and they're not dressed the way, you know, you think they ought to be dressed to come to church, don't go over and tell them they need a haircut. Go over and put your arm around them and tell you how much you love them and you're so glad they're with you that morning. And ask them to come down and sit with you. Oh, please, my little children, love one another. For that is the only way that we are ever going to get out of this world. God is waiting for a people that are truly like Jesus. When the character of Christ is perfectly reproduced in His people, then He will come and claim them as His own. And not before. Jesus is not waiting for more wars or more earthquakes or more famines in this world. He is not waiting for some great war in the Middle East. I tell you, there have been enough wars. There's been enough famines. God is not waiting for the world to get worse and worse. He's waiting for His people to get better and better. Jesus is not waiting for us to go out and baptize the whole world. He's not interested in quantity. He's interested in quality. I say this tonight, and I believe it with all my heart, that if we should evangelize the whole world and baptize every soul in this world as a Seventh-day Adventist, the Lord still won't come. Because that's not what He wants. He wants a people that He can point to and say, look, there are those that have the patience of the saints. There are those that are keeping My commandments, not by their power, but by My righteousness that is living itself out within them. It is Jesus who can make us perfect and make us righteous and pure. And it's a matter of our going into our closet and getting down on our knees and spending some time with Him and surrendering ourselves and letting Him do it. I used to preach about, you know, Vietnam and famines in India and all that stuff. Until I realized one day, as I was reading Matthew 24, and I don't know where I'd been all my life. Matthew 24, Jesus says there will be wars and rumors of wars and all those things. I used to think those were signs of the end. And all of a sudden, one day, I read Matthew, and I said, Jesus says there will be wars and rumors of wars, and He says, and the end will not yet be. Jesus says there's always been wars. There's going to be lots more. I used to preach about the population explosion. I used to say, you know, boy, by the year 2000, there are going to be so many people in this world, the Lord's got to come because we run out of food. Listen, if this people with the three angels' messages, with the spirit of prophecy on our shelves, if we don't do something with our lives in the way of righteousness and becoming like Jesus through His grace, there will be a great famine and billions of people will starve. But the Lord will not come. For the Lord cannot bring the great controversy to an end until His name has been vindicated. That is the issue. And if we do not do it, then it will be up to our grandchildren. And if they do not do it, it will be up to their grandchildren. And if they do not do it, this world will see the year 3000. Because the issue involved is not a morally declining and debauched world. If that was the case, if that was what God was waiting for, He would have brought the great controversy to an end with Noah. The world was so bad that He had to wipe it out and start over with 8. I think that should be convincing enough to us that that's not the issue. The issue is that we perfectly reproduce the character of Jesus Christ in our lives by His grace, by the indwelling of His Spirit, And God says to us tonight, oh, surrender and let me do it so we can get out of here. Listen, my friends, we are not waiting for the second coming. It is Jesus who is waiting for the second coming. The decision whether He comes now or 1,000 years from now lies in our hands this evening. And I know I want to see Jesus in my life. I don't want to get old. I walk through nursing homes and I see people in there who once were human beings with dignity and honor and had self-respect. Great individuals, and they get old and they lose their self-control and their dignity and they go back to diapers again. Oh, I tell you, Jesus has to come before that happens to us that's in here tonight. Just has to. And Jesus is waiting to rescue us. My little children, love one another. You know, Judas really wasn't a bad guy. He really wasn't. The only thing that was wrong with Judas was that Judas wanted to do it Judas's way. There's a song that's sung in some commercial that runs around on TV. It goes, "Have it your way." You know the song. That was Judas's only problem. He wanted to do it his way. And you know what really scares me about Judas is that when I look at my own life, I realize that that's my problem. I just want to do it my way. You know, everybody doing his own thing. Do your own thing, man. That was Judas's song. And what really scares me is everybody I've ever met so far in my life has had the same problem. They want to do it their way. And Jesus says, hey, please, let me come into your life. Let's do it my way, because it's the only way. If there was just some way tonight that I could just know that you understood. Would you sing with me tonight again? My Jesus, I love Thee, I know. Loving Father, we thank You tonight for helping us to understand the truth that You're not waiting for some evangelist to come up with a fantastic new handbill that will bring in the world. That You're not waiting for a departmental man to develop a new program. But that You're waiting for a people to get on their knees and become one. Oh God, possess us tonight. This might be done in our time. In Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. Free listening of this message and over 7,000 other presentations by more than 100 speakers on 50 different topics is now available on our American Christian Ministries mobile app for Android and Apple devices, and on our secure website. You may also order presentations online at AmericanChristianMinistries.org or call 800-233-4450. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry. as we help to prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.